From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this edition, what the left says doesn't happen, happened, according to the New York Times, happened in the red state of Georgia during their recent primary election. Hundreds of cases of double voting, voter fraud. Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, announced that an investigation is now underway. He joins us with more details in just a moment. And what steps can you take to make sure your vote counts? What's the best way to do that? Well, we're going to talk about that with FRC Action Vice President Brent Kylan. And the wonderful world of Disney. It's not so wonderful after all. Disney's new release of Mulan is being upstaged by the company's connection to communist China and the fact they filmed the movie with the aid of the very people who are responsible for the religious and cultural repression of the Uyghurs in China. Now, remember, this is the same company that threatened to boycott Georgia. We'll talk more about that with Bob Fu, FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom and President of China Aid. And a good contrast to the hypocrisy of Hollywood, the Department of Justice, the Trump Department of Justice, that is once again weighing in on behalf of religious freedom, this time in Indiana on behalf of the Catholic Church. Eric Dryban, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, joins me with the details later here on Washington Watch. The website is TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it is at T Perkins. Let me remind you, 8 p.m. Wednesday night is Pray Vote Stand. You can be a part of it. We'll have a special focus tonight. George Barna joins me. PrayVoteStand.org, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. All right, ahead of the November election, the idea of possible voter fraud has to be considered as there is a major push for universal mail-in balloting. Now, I'll be very clear up front, I am not opposed to early voting, not opposed to absentee voting, but there's concerns about what's happening in the mail and how these ballots are being protected. Now, we're told this doesn't happen. Well, in the red state of Georgia, there are reports that suggest that at least 1,000 people have reportedly double voted, meaning they voted absentee by mail and then they showed up to the polls to vote in the primary and the runoff elections just last month. Joining me now to talk about what is taking place there, he has announced an investigation. He is the Georgia Secretary of State, responsible for the elections in the Peach State, is Brad Raffensperger, Secretary of State. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, let's just jump right into this. What have you discovered and why are you investigating?
Well, we ran after the primary and off the runoff we had in July, we ran a detailed analysis and just checked voter records and what came up with about 1,000 voters in about 120 of 159 counties had voted twice. So we have 1,000 voters that voted twice. We had one man actually was quite proud of it and bragging to the newspapers and a sheriff that he had voted twice. So we dug into it. And we're continuing our investigation, and we'll be presenting that to the state election board.
So, Secretary Raffensperger, that's a crime to vote twice, is it not?
It's actually a felony, so it's not just a misdemeanor. You're facing 1 to 10 years in prison and a fine up to $100,000.
So did I describe that right, that they voted absentee by mail? Did they request this absentee mail-in ballot?
Yes. In Georgia, you cannot vote absentee unless you request the ballot. So you requested an absentee ballot, they filled it out, and they sent it in. So they know that they did that. The voter was aware that he did that, or she. Then they went ahead and they showed up at the polls and then wanted to vote again. And they cajoled or worked their way through the system. It was not really the equipment part. It was really the people part where there's a breakdown there. But in effect, they got to vote twice. And it didn't affect any of the elections, but their vote was recorded twice, once in person and once absentee. And that's obviously a crime.
Now, in this particular case, you've been able to verify that this did not affect the election. I assume that's because none of these elections were close enough to have been shifted by, a handful of votes per precinct.
Correct. It was not, but we had a race for a governor a few years ago, and Governor Kemp won by 53,000. If that margin would have been tighter, something like that could have, you know, shifted an election. But what it really, in effect, what you're really doing, there's 1,000 people that voted twice, in effect, disenfranchise 1,000 voters, because they got two votes, and you and I, we got one vote.
Right. But it, theoretically, in what we look at different parts of the country where you see some of these local elections that are decided by less than six votes, this could have altered the outcome.
Absolutely. We had a state representative won his race by less than 50 votes. I believe it was less than 25 votes. So something like that could, you know, push an election to one side or the other. And so it's very serious. And so that's why we have a full-blown investigation going on that goes to the state election board. Once they do their work, it goes to the attorney general. And then we're going to, because of the large numbers, we will send that down to each of the affected counties, to their district attorneys for their further action. And the U.S. attorneys for the Northern, Middle, and Southern District, they might want to take a look at it also, because there were federal elections on that race.
So, Secretary Ratzenberger, you have stated there's systems in place to catch this, and many of these were probably caught.
Yes.
But in what's happening right now, because of the coronavirus and all this other stuff that's all the stuff that's happening, is there's a shortage of poll workers, longer lines, and you've had new machines in place. So there were some circumstances here that lent itself to being exploited.
Well, new machines and then new poll workers. Our average age was 72 prior to COVID, so looking for poll workers and then training them. During a pandemic, it's very difficult. It was difficult in the spring to do that hands-on training. And so we're now circling back with all the counties, making sure we have enough poll workers, enough training and retraining to get everyone ready, but also going back to policies and procedures that this would happen again. But, you know, obviously, our radar's up, the county's radar's up, and we'll be watching for every voter. We want everyone to vote once.
Right. Well, Mr. Secretary, I mean, I think in this situation, you have a system in place that normally would catch this. You've just outlined a few unique circumstances that allowed some people to, again, game the system, manipulate it, and get a second vote. Are you concerned if you were to extrapolate this out across the country and you have, you know, states where they did universal mail-out ballots, even though they're not set up to do that, are you concerned that we could see wider spread voter fraud in this election?
My concern with universal mail-out ballots is we try very hard to keep our voter rolls clean, fresh, and accurate. But Americans are mobile. 11% of Americans move every year. And when you just send out ballots, an active live ballot, you don't know if that person still lives there. And that's why I believe the best approach is that you have to request a ballot is sent to you, and then we also do signature match. So you have to have some appropriate guardrails in place.
Yeah, I mean, you want everybody to vote. You want everybody who wants to participate vote, but you want to make sure it's that person who is actually voting. I mean, I think that's very reasonable. I mean, you've got to show an ID to get on a plane, to cash a check. You've got to make sure that it's you. You're not just going to hand off money to people not knowing it's them. I mean, a vote, as you pointed out, one vote, one person. And that's significant. When other people take advantage of that, they're depriving their fellow citizens of their vote and their voice.
It's cheating and gaming the system, and it's for an unfair advantage. And we are going to really work hard to make sure it's shut down, doesn't happen again. But also, it does point that additional election reforms need to happen next year, both at the federal level and then at the state level also.
Well, in Georgia, as you pointed out, you keep your voter rolls clean as possible. As you say, we're a very transient society. People move around. But some states are not as, on top of it. And that affects all of us, because what happens, you know, while Georgia elections are fine within the borders of Georgia, you mentioned, you know, these elections, some of these are federal elections. And so that, you know, a state that is not on top of their voter rolls deprive the other states of fair representation when it comes to the federal elections.
It's never been easier to vote. We have obviously absentee voting, which you've had in place since 2005. We have, you know, 3 weeks of early voting and the election day. We just want to make sure that people that show up are who they say they are. They're Georgia citizens, and we wish them all the best.
I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. One final question for you, Mr. Secretary. Have you, has the state of Georgia altered their voting procedures or extended their times because of the coronavirus and more, you know, people skittish about going to the polls with long lines and crowds?
We really didn't have to. We already had no-excuse absentee ballots in place. We do have an online portal. You can go to securevotega.com, and you can do an online application for your absentee ballot, which has been very well received. We still have the 15 days of early voting, and we still have, you know, Tuesday, November 3rd. So we did not really have to make any changes. We did add absentee ballot drop boxes to make that help with the rush that we expected, and we did have a big increase in absentee. But generally, our system was very flexible to could really flex with the changes of COVID-19.
So you did see an increase in absentee voting in the primaries?
Yes, we went from 4 to 6%, and we're now up to 40 to 60% of absentee ballots. So that's the increase that we've seen.
That's a pretty significant increase.
There, people in Georgia have always wanted to vote in person, and up until COVID-19, that's how Georgians typically voted.
Yeah. Well, at least you have systems in place to ensure that every vote will count. And I commend you for immediately getting on this and investigating these reports of the evidence that would suggest double voting. Mr. Secretary, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Take care, Tony.
All right. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. And, you know, this is a red state. Now, Georgia is a state that's being targeted by the left. Not to say that everybody double voted was on the left, but there is an effort to target some of these red states. And I saw this a number of years ago where you know, people think, well, they're just going to go after the purple states. No, the purple states are trending. They're going after some of the hardcore red states. They're working on Texas, Georgia. And these states need to be very vigilant. Oklahoma is another one I think is going to be a prime target. They need to be very vigilant about their voter rolls and how they're doing voting and not be bullied into expanding voting options. You know, as the secretary there just laid out, look, they can accommodate this because they're working within the normal procedures. Now, what the left is pushing for, clamoring for, is this universal mail-in balloting, meaning everybody that's on the voter rolls gets a ballot. We're going to talk more about that coming up next. Brent Kylan joins me, Vice President of FRC Action. We're going to talk about what's the best way to vote. A lot of confusion out there. Some people concerned about voting in person because of the coronavirus. Others want to make, they're concerned their vote might not be counted. So there's many ways to vote, and we're going to talk about that. What's the best way, what you should do, and how you can make sure your vote counts. And then we're going to be talking about how you can influence the election by talking about the issues. And we're going to talk a little bit, give you a preview for tonight's Pray Vote Stand broadcast, 8 p.m. Eastern. Don't go away. We're back next with Brent Kylan.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. 8 p.m., Pray Vote Stand. Go to PrayVoteStand.org. Tonight, looking at the importance of worldview. What's your worldview? And how can you make a difference in this upcoming election? What's at stake in this election? That's tonight's focus. Well, voter fraud, you know, something that doesn't happen, according to the left, is happening. We've seen cases of it in New Jersey this spring. We're just talking with the Secretary of State of the red state of Georgia, where at least 1,000 cases have been identified. Now, that's cases that, as he said, were they got through the system and they found it out later. They were able to, because what happens, I mean, it's pretty easy to find out. You go to the polls and you vote and they take down your name, they mark it off. And then they all of a sudden they see a mail-in ballot come in from the same person. They voted twice. Now, what should have happened and what didn't in this case is that when those folks showed up to the polls to vote, because they voted early, it should have already been indicated by their name that they had voted or requested a mail-in ballot. No telling how many other people attempted to vote a second time but were turned away because they were identified as previously voting. Well, joining me now to talk more about the concerns nationwide with voter fraud and how you can best protect your vote to ensure that it counts is Brent Kylan, Vice President of FRC Action. Brent, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be with you.
So Brent, I know I want to be very clear here because there's a lot of confusion over, you know, the president has said, you know, he's opposed to mail-in balloting. He's talking about universal mail-in balloting. All right. That's when the state will send out a ballot to every person that is on the voter rolls, whether they ask for it or not. Only If I'm not mistaken, only a couple of states actually have that presently, Washington, Oregon, where they have universal all mail-in balloting. So they're set up for it. Other states are not. Now, what we're not concerned about or opposed to is early voting, people who would maybe request absentee ballot or show up before Election Day to vote or vote on Election Day. So you really have kind of three options, do you not?
Yeah, Tony, that's exactly right. And I think the thing to really focus on here to make sure that the integrity of your ballot is protected is really the chain of custody for the ballot. And as much as you can, you really want your ballot to touch as few hands as possible. So like you outlined, Tony, there really are kind of three ways to vote. There's that in-person voting on Election Day. There's also, in most states, there's in-person early voting. You have to check your state rules to see what those rules are. But most states offer that. Actually, coming up even this month, some states are starting that. States like Michigan and Pennsylvania, you can vote early and in person. And then the third way is that mail-in ballot or absentee ballot. Some states use different terms or even use the terms interchangeably. But as you look at that, like you said, you know, all of those options are viable. I would encourage people, really, if you can, do the in-person early voting. In-person voting on Election Day is great too. But if you vote early in person, say you have a medical emergency come up or some inclement weather, you know, because your ballot has been cast, that it's in the bank. If you can't do that, you know, you can vote in person on Election Day. And if you can't do that, definitely vote by mail. Whatever you do, make sure that you're getting that ballot in.
Right. I want to be very, very clear on this so that, you know, people are not discouraged if their only option or the best option for them is to vote by mail. If that's the best option for you to request a ballot and then vote by mail, then by all means do that. But as Brent lined out, personally, what I do is I usually vote early. I go because the polls are usually open for like a week long, a couple of weeks before the election, and the line, there's hardly anybody in there normally, or at least very few people, and I go in and I vote. So that, as you said, if something comes up Election Day, I've got to be somewhere, I got to travel, I'm not going to miss voting. And it, especially for those that are in, you know, high-risk categories, because there's still some fear over the coronavirus, although I think it's, quite frankly, I think the coronavirus fear is being flamed, the flame of fear is being fanned by the media for this very reason, to try to discourage people from voting. And so if you're in a high-risk category, vote early or vote absentee by mail, but by all means vote. Now, Brent, we have seen cases of voter fraud, and so this is a real issue, is it not?
It is a real issue, Tony, absolutely. And as you pointed out earlier in the program, you know, some of these states are making these changes last minute and just don't have the infrastructure yet to be pulling this off. So it is something we absolutely need to be taking seriously. And I would just add, if you are in that that category of you just feel like you do need to vote by mail, a couple of things to look out for. Just make sure you understand how to request that ballot and understand how to return the ballot. If you can, if you're in a state where you can be the one requesting that, that really puts you in charge of that process. And then return, I would say make sure you understand what the state deadlines are, because they do depend on the state. And then get that in earlier rather than later, just in case there's a hiccup with the postal system or something like that, that gives you as much time as you can to make sure that gets in there for you.
Right. And in some states like Georgia, we were just talking about, allow you to drop that off.
Yes.
So you can actually drop it off yourself, which would be a preferred over putting it in the U.S. Postal Service. Brent Kylan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
All right, folks. And tonight, again, 8 p.m. Eastern time, PrayVoteStand.org. You can find out more about some of the issues surrounding this fall's election. And by the way, have you taken the challenge to pray, vote, and stand? You can do so at TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
Are you looking to grow closer in your relationship with Jesus and in your knowledge of God's Word? Family Research Council has released a new three-part series titled Three Ways to Read the Bible. In this series, Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, shares helpful ways to be encouraged and directed by God's truth through studying and applying the Bible's text. Now's the time to get to know God through His Word by looking into the Bible and learning what it says about God, humanity, and the power of Scripture. During the season of isolation, devote time to the Lord and seek out His meaning for you. In times of crisis and any time, this blog series is a great primer on opening your eyes and heart to Him through His Word. Check out this helpful resource and learn how to read the Bible with not just your eyes, but your heart. To learn more, visit frcblog.com. That's frcblog.com.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com, and you can take the challenge at TonyPerkins.com. All right, do you know how to spell hypocrisy? It's D-I-S-N-E-Y, Disney. Now, let me just refresh your memory. In 2016, Disney, the filmmaker, threatened to boycott the state of Georgia, which has given very generous incentive to the movie industry, to Hollywood. I think 20% break on taxes, another 10% if they put the peach on their closing credits. They threatened to boycott Georgia because of a proposed religious freedom restoration law that the legislature passed, but then weak-kneed former Governor Deal vetoed it. Well, knowing that that threat worked in 2016, they again threatened in 2019, last year, in May of last year to be exact, the CEO of Disney threatened to boycott the state if the state went forward with, or actually they had already gone forward with it, that was the heartbeat bill, a pro-life bill. They said that they just couldn't do work for them. In fact, Disney led the way for Hollywood, and then others piled on, like Netflix. I love what they say, the hypocrisy. It drips with hypocrisy. Quote, "We have many women working on productions in Georgia whose rights, along with millions of others, will be severely restricted by this law. It is why we will work with the ACLU and others to fight it in court." Well, apparently, Disney has a problem with religious freedom and with the sanctity of human life, laws that would uphold that in Georgia. And so they're not going to do business in Georgia. At least that's what they threatened. But their new movie, Mulan, is raising a lot of eyebrows because the movie was actually made with the assistance of a number of the members of the Communist Party who are actually a part of repressing and penalizing and persecuting religious minorities in China. Joining me now to talk more about this, Bob Fu, Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom here at FRC and the President of China A. Bob, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony, for having me again.
We expect China to do crazy stuff, and we know China, the communist China, represses people. But the hypocrisy of Disney here is quite striking, is it not?
It is, Tony. I mean, what Disney has done on this Mulan movie, not only, I mean, showing its deep hypocrisy, it even goes much further as becomes an enabler of those repressive regime like the Chinese Communist Party, you know, by really working directly in the most complicit way with the Public Security Bureau of Turpan Police Station and Propaganda Department in the Uyghur Autonomous Region, that those entities are already in Americans' sanction lists for their abuse and holding these 1 million Uyghurs in the concentration camp.
I think that's an extremely important point. That this now, I know the movie was made. It's been a couple years in the making, but the Trump administration has placed sanctions on some of these very entities that Disney was listing in their credits. I mean, I find it very difficult, given all the attention that's been placed on the Uyghurs in the last 4 years, that Disney would have no knowledge of what was taking place there in China.
Well, according to the timing of the production, you can tell very clearly this movie was partially produced right after the Communist Party started established these concentration camps, these so-called internment camps or de-extremication mind transformation camps for over a million Uyghurs and Kazakhs and even Chinese Christians. So the Disney moved in, you know, after 2017 and partially made this movie. And furthermore, the star of this movie, Liu Yifei, the actress, she became a public mouthpiece of the Communist Party's crackdown in Hong Kong by publicly endorsing the Communist Party's police brutal suppression of the Hong Kong peaceful protesters. So, I mean, those anyone who has a conscience, I mean, should really, I mean, reconsider from watching this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And quite frankly, a lot of Hollywood's movies, because Hollywood, in many ways, is now kowtowing to communist China. I mean, we talked about it before, and we'll probably talk more about this connection between Hollywood and the Communist Party in China, how they're basically allowing the Communist Party to dictate the contents of movies. Bob Fu, thanks so much for joining us. Always great to have you on.
Thank you, Tony. Yeah, we're
dancing with the boss. All right, in a good contrast to Hollywood, we've got the Trump Department of Justice that is jumping in to defend religious freedom, this time in Indiana with a Catholic diocese. The Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Eric Dreiben, is here next. Don't go away.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increased pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/sexuality. Again, that's frc.org/sexuality.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
With horrifying acceleration in recent years, verified reports of murders, rapes, mutilations, and kidnapping of Christians in Nigeria have persistently increased. These attacks are frequently accompanied by the torching of homes, churches, villages, and agricultural fields. A July 15, 2020 headline reports that over 1,000 Nigerian Christians were killed in the first 6 months of 2020. This is in addition to 11,000 Christians who have been killed since June 2015. News stories about the assaults in Nigeria are rarely reported in mainstream media outlets. But when they are, they're regularly explained away as effects of climate change, local feuds, or religious wars for which both sides bear equal responsibility. For more information about the persecution of Christians in Nigeria, read FRC's publication, The Crisis of Christian Persecution in Nigeria, at frc.org/Nigeria.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, the website tonyperkins.com. Have you taken the challenge yet? All right, 1 million people. That's the goal, to take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand. And folks, if you see what's happening on any given day in America, if that doesn't convince you we need to pray, I'm not sure what would. In fact, tonight we'll be praying 8 p.m., pray, vote, stand. Special guest will actually have former sheriff from Milwaukee County, who was right there in Kenosha. He's going to be with us, as well as a business owner whose business was burned down in the riots. Going to be joining us. Pray, Vote, Stand tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. PrayVoteStand.org, and you can be a part of that. All right. On Tuesday, the Justice Department filed a friend of the court brief in with the Indiana Supreme Court in support of the Catholic Archdiocese First Amendments, their First Amendment rights, in the case of a former high school teacher who sued the Archdiocese for being dismissed from his position. Joining me now to break down some of the details of this development is the Department of Justice Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Eric Dryban. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Tony, thanks for having me back. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, I saw this, and I just wanted to bring this to our listeners' attention, that while we see religious freedom, you know, being stifled in some parts of the country, California, Nevada, just to mention a couple, that we have an administration that, because of a task force that was set up back in 2018, I believe, you are actually scanning the horizon for cases that would infringe upon religious freedom, First Amendment rights, and you're getting involved. Tell us about this latest case in Indiana.
Well, Tony, this case grew out of a dispute between a school teacher at a religious high school and the Catholic Church in central Indiana. So The teacher at issue was involved in a public same-sex marriage. The church is of the view that marriage is between a baptized man and a baptized woman is a sacramental marriage, but generally between a man and a woman. And so the bishop told the school that it had a choice to make. If it wanted to continue to associate with the church, the school had to sever its relationship with the teacher because the teacher was engaged in a public same-sex marriage that was at odds with the teachings and doctrine of the church. Or it could continue to employ the teacher and then sever its relationship with the church. So the school decided that it wanted to remain affiliated with the church, ended the employment relationship with the teacher. The teacher then turned around and sued the Catholic Church in state trial court, and that lawsuit is now pending, and it's pending before the Supreme Court of Indiana. And so we filed, as you said, a friend of the court brief in support of the right under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the church to run its affairs as it deems appropriate, to exercise its faith, and to practice its religion as it deems appropriate. We think the lawsuit, therefore, should fail.
So religious freedom applies both to religious entities and to individuals, to people. But what is religious freedom if it's not the ability to live out your faith and allow it to guide your directions in the decisions that you make?
That's exactly right, Tony. And I think this case is critically important to the ability of all of us to practice our religion. In particular, central to many of us, but central, I think, to the First Amendment to the Constitution, is the right of religious people and their institutions, and particularly churches, to educate students in their faith. And in this particular case, the church took the position that, among other things, that its teachers had to support the teachings of the church, had to pray with students, had to model a Christ-centered life, and convey the church's teachings and messages to its students in all aspects of life, not simply in a religion class, but in every way. And here, the church concluded, led by the bishop, that what was happening was inconsistent with teachings of the church, and so it gave the school a choice. The school made its choice to continue to affiliate with the church, and this lawsuit essentially seeks a lot of money from the church for simply exercising its religion, and we think that is wholly improper and prohibited by the First Amendment protections that we all enjoy and should enjoy.
Eric Dryban, we've actually seen some Supreme Court decisions recently that would actually speak to this, have we not?
Yes, and in fact, we've just received a very important decision in late June by the Supreme Court of the United States in a case called Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Morrissey Beirut. And that case involved a couple of school teachers who brought discrimination lawsuits. And the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 decision, concluded that the lawsuits could not go forward because the First Amendment permitted those religious schools to treat as what are called ministers, not literally ministers, but treat as functionally as ministers under the First Amendment. And therefore, it was improper for courts to get in the middle of decisions between teachers who were engaged in educating their students in their religion, and that the lawsuits there could therefore could not go forward. And so that was an important victory for religious freedom. And we supported, by the way, in those cases as well. We appeared in support of the schools right. In those cases. Yeah.
Eric, I mean, when I look at the facts of this case, this is kind of reminds me of what we hear all the time, the left clamoring about, the separation of church and state. I mean, this is actually the principle that Jefferson, I think, made reference to in his letter to the Danbury Baptist in Connecticut about this kind of wall of separation, if you will, where the state can't reach into the church. And I mean, that's what we're talking about here, is that the state not dictating the actions and policies of the church based upon their faith.
That's exactly right. I mean, the notion that a state trial court and litigants, that is, people suing a church, can invade the decision-making of a religious institution, or in particular a church that simply expresses its faith and wants to live out its religion, is wholly inconsistent with, in my view, what this country stands for, and in particular, the First Amendment. I mean, it would be a gross invasion of the free exercise of religion and the right of this church and any church, for that matter, to allow, you know, court proceedings, judges dictating to ministers, rabbis, imams, preachers, whoever they are, how they must exercise their faith. And that's what this case is about. And so we think that the Indiana Supreme Court, and we do argue this in our brief, the Indiana Supreme Court should rule in favor of the church and throw this case out of court.
Eric, one final question for you. And I again want to commend you and your team for, you know, really bird dogging these cases and being out there. But I want our listeners to understand that these are not, these are not just aberrations. These are not just a few cases that are out there. I mean, we've seen this cultural shift brought on, and I can say this, maybe you can't, but I can say it, from the policies of the previous administration that created hostility toward religious freedom. And if we don't have a Department of Justice at the federal level and we don't have attorneys general at the state level that are defending religious freedom, it is at risk in this country, is it not?
Well, I think we have to be zealous in protecting religious freedom. I agree. There are people, institutions, and people in this country who obviously have a different point of view, Tony, than you do or I do about the protections of the First Amendment. And I think what we saw in this case, the state trial court judge refused to dismiss the case. And so fortunately, the church, with our support, have gone up to the Indiana Supreme Court. But, I mean, so, yes, I agree with you. We have to be vigilant. And we have to continue to do everything we can to protect religious freedom in this country, because there are people who oppose it and oppose it aggressively.
I said that was the final question, but I got one more question for you. Unrelated to this, maybe you can't go into it. I know you got to be careful what you talk about. But, you know, we still see churches being targeted in states like California and Nevada, being treated unfairly in terms of their religious freedom, ability to gather, to meet, to gather, to worship freely. Do we see anything on the horizon that may suggest that we could see some changes?
Well, Tony, as you know, we've talked about before, we have been very aggressive, including in California and in Nevada, in seeking protections for religious gatherings, and we will continue to do that. Of course, I can't talk about things that are not public, but we are continuing to review vigilantly orders by governors, mayors, and others around the country, and to the extent there are restrictions on religious freedom, we will continue to take action in favor of religious liberty. I mean, of course, during a pandemic, you know, state and local officials have very broad authority. We respect that authority, but there are times when their authority infringes upon the right of all of us to practice our faith, and we will do everything we can to defend that right.
I just wanted to make sure everybody knew it was still on your radar.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All right. Eric Dryban, as always, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, Eric Dryban, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice. This is, folks, this is, I cannot underscore this enough, how important it is where you have an administration that is actually defending religious freedom as opposed to persecuting religious freedom. And that's what we're looking at in this election. This election is about whether or not we will have religious freedom. And when we talk about religious freedom, it's what I go back to what I said to Eric at the beginning. Religious freedom is not just what's between your two ears. It's the ability to live out your faith, to take your actions, to make your decisions based upon that faith. That's what's at stake. Whether or not we have that freedom, or we see that freedom restrained, or possibly and ultimately eliminated. It's not hyperbole. Look, we see it happening all across America. Joining me now to talk more about this, Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs here at the Family Research Council. Travis, this is significant, again, that the Department of Justice is weighing in on a state case. This is a state case. So I want to make it very clear. This is in state court. But it does have applications for the First Amendment, and they're weighing in.
Tony, this is significant, and I think Assistant Attorney General Dryban said it well. This administration has a solid record of religious freedom. The DOJ under President Trump so far has been filing statements of interest and amicus briefs in cases at a rate of one every 2 months. That's greater than President George W. Bush and Obama had filed such briefs in support of religious freedom. We see, furthermore, the instance of religious freedom here defending a school's right on matters of sexuality and family, the most one of the most attacked issues these days, evidence of their willingness to take a stand on this issue. We need that. And this election is going to decide whether we're going to have that or not, because I can point to a number of things in a Biden-Harris administration that would not defend religious freedom.
Well, I mean, this speaks to the very heart of the Equality Act that Joe Biden has made as his number one legislative priority, which would trump religious freedom with sexual libertinism.
They've pledged to make that a priority passed in the first 100 days on their website. So, you know, they're being upfront with what their agenda is for religious freedom. Add to this, Harris, as Senator Harris pushing or co-sponsoring legislation that would gut RFRA, deny religious freedom for adoption providers, her questioning of nominees about their religious beliefs in multiple instances about their fitness for office because they hold religious beliefs. Biden, while a senator, voting against constitutional amendments allowing prayer in school, barring federal courts from dealing with cases dealing with public prayer in schools. I mean, there are a litany of things that we could point to a Biden-Harris administration working against religious freedom, and I didn't even list them all there.
I mean, let me step back here and just unpack for a moment this particular case in Indiana with the Catholic diocese. Is have a Catholic school, I think it was called the chapel, cathedral, sorry, that, you know, people send their kids to. You know, I want to send my kids to a Catholic school so they'll maybe be somewhat, you know, immune from or protected from the cultural forces that are out there in the public schools. And so they have a teacher who is in a same-sex marriage relationship, which is obviously counter to the teaching of the Catholic Church. The archdiocese says to the cathedral, look, you got to make a choice here. Either you're going to be Catholic and stay with us and continue to be under our umbrella and abide by Catholic teaching, biblical teaching, or you can stay with a same-sex teacher and you're going to be on your own.
Hey, Tony, I mean, that's basically it. It should be a straightforward case. But what you have now is under the guise of employment protections, others wanting to come in and dictate who, in this case, the Catholic Church and the school will hire or fire, which affects how your faith is taught and propagated. So it's crystal clear. Even, you know, we go back to the Hosanna-Tabor case, a 9-0 decision from the Supreme Court. Remember, Biden was vice president when Obama argued aggressively to the court that that school should not have the right to determine who taught his faith. There's a clear choice here. Do we want religious institutions and churches and schools to have the autonomy to decide that, or be told by society, though it's hostile to our faith, how we should teach the faith and what it means having our faith hijacked in the eyes of the outsider and letting them teach it?
See, the left's view of religious freedom is what we've heard before, freedom of worship. They'll let you go inside the four walls of your church when you want to, maybe. Well, actually, not even now. They won't let you do that. But they're certainly not going to allow you to live out your faith so that it would affect your business, the way you raise your children, and the schools you send them to.
And Tony, you know, just the ability to take a stand in the public square as a believer, many other manifestations of how we live our faith, all of this is under threat by those hostile to religious freedom in society today.
Travis Weber, thanks so much for joining us. Folks, thank you for joining us. And tune in, PrayVoteStand.org, 8 p.m. Eastern Time for more. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234. 7234.